But that kind of brings me to essentially what I want to talk about today. And I want to pick up where I left off last Sabbath when I introduced to you the subject that we were talking about. And that is very simply with regard to whether or not, and if you recall, I left you with a question, whether or not you are riders in the storm or whether or not you are warriors in the storm. And I presented the option, or at least the suggestion, that you would at least take some time to think about that over the week, because I inferred the fact that there is a very big distinction between being just a rider in the storm or a warrior in the storm. So before I go ahead and essentially get into that, I want to reiterate something that I made very clear, I think, at least in the opening, I thought I did anyway, and that is to remind all of us, brethren, we are living in a very, very unique country in the world. It is special. It is unlike anything in the history of the world, as I had mentioned before. The United States of America and the documents that it was founded on and that underpin our freedoms and liberty are unlike anything that has ever been tried in terms of managing a population, and let alone now a population of 300 plus million people. I think we're up to about 325 million people just here in the United States alone, let alone the other 35 to 40 up in Canada million that live up there. My point is, unlike any country in the world, we, the United States of America, are actually beneficiaries of something that is very, very special. Even the nation of Israel, of old, of Saul and King David and Solomon, Rehoboam, the divided kingdom, whether it was Judah or whether it was the northern 10 tribes, Israel, there was nothing like us here in the United States. Very different. Very, very different. And I hope, and as I said last week, I hope and I pray that we really do take time to appreciate our country from time to time and the amount of blood, sweat, and tears it's costed this country over the years to maintain and preserve these freedoms and liberties that we all so enjoy. But even though we are different, and it's obvious, than what Israel was in the day of old, because Israel was a monarchy, primarily, basically. Whether it was Judah in the divided kingdom and Israel, or whether it was before the divided kingdom occurred and it was just David and Solomon, they were a monarchy. They had a king. You know, our president is not a king, even though, as I said, some may say, well, that's King Obama, you know, that's King Nixon, or that's King Trump, you know. Well, no, I mean, you can say all that kind of stuff, and that's pure rhetoric, frankly, because it's not the way it's written in the documents. The fact of it is we have three checks and balances, primarily three fulcrums in our government that make up our platform that we work on. That's the judicial system and, of course, the administration and the legislative branch, and they operate in a cohesive, or at least it should be anyway, a cooperative manner, that was the intent, so that there would be a check and balance among the three to keep everybody, so to speak, honest and forthright. But the reality of it is that even though we are different, we do have something in common with Israel. The commonality that we have with Israel as a nation is that we are a nation of laws, brethren. As the God of Israel is a God of law and order. God doesn't like confusion. God doesn't like disorder. God does not like anarchy. He does not like violence in so many respects, as we are seeing play out in our country today. No. God is a God of law and order, without a doubt. And so I present this for your consideration. And that's all I'm going to be talking about today, because I want to talk about something that I hope when we leave today you will consider very seriously. Because you and me, and you there on the internet, and welcome, by the way, to services here in Medina, Ohio, the fact of it is we have an opportunity to let our voices be heard. Do you know how special that is? That you and I have the freedom, and I'll say it this way, a civic right. A civic right. A citizen's right to let your voice be heard on those who are to be elected to serve in leading the country. That's right. You have opportunity to participate in that civic right. In that civic right. Do you know why? Because uniquely enough, brethren, this is a government of and by and for the people. Do we realize that? Do we understand what a privilege, what a piece of grace that is, that we have the opportunity to be able to go into a place and leverage our citizenship into a vote? Now everybody said, oh, but, no, come on. Let's get real about this. Just because we exercise a civic duty or right does not cancel out your citizenship in heaven. Brethren, think this through. Yes, we're ambassadors for Christ. But if I take opportunity to go ahead and vote for some kind of cause in my city, or some kind of cause in my county, or some kind of cause in my state, or for some kind of cause for my country, that's going to cancel out my citizenship in heaven and cancel me out as an ambassador of Jesus Christ? Come on. Let's get real, brethren. No. That's not how it works. That's not how it works at all. As a matter of fact, as citizens of the United States, it's incredible that we have the opportunity to be able to express our opinions and let our voice be heard in this manifested right that we have as citizens. It's a wonderful, wonderful right. And as I said, if some of us should so happen to feel responsible enough to translate it into a sense of duty, more power to you. More power to you. Because frankly, the cost has been high. Lots of arms and legs have been sacrificed on the altars of World War. Oh, let me go back. The Civil War. No, let me go back. The Revolutionary War. The Civil War. World War I and World War II. Not to mention, besides limbs, arms and legs, fingers and toes, but lives. Lives. Of both men and women who stood up for causes to allow their voices to be heard so that they could now have a sense of citizen right in expression to be translated into duty. However, when I say duty, that assumes the fact that we are not low information voters. It assumes the fact that if you have a responsibility, especially in this citizen's right that we might exercise and choose to translate into a duty, take opportunity to participate in this, it's incumbent then on all of us, brother. Without a doubt, it's incumbent on all of us to become educated on who we are going to choosing to lead our country in certain areas. It goes without saying. It goes without saying. Shame on us if we just go in unknowing of who we are supporting or going to provide our voice to back up and give them the right to take the reins in a role that we are choosing to participate, to vote for. Now, I get it. Some of us don't want to vote. That's fine. I'm not necessarily talking to you. I'm not even arguing that point. But what I am arguing, and what I am trying to bring up here, brethren, is that we, the people in this case, have opportunity to let our voices be heard. And frankly, that is a tremendous, tremendous and incredible privilege and right that we all have at our fingertips. You know, Ronald Reagan said something that was rather profound. Not that I'm a Republican. Not that I'm even a supporter of Ronald Reagan. Don't even read into that. I'm just quoting a man. That's all I'm doing. He said, you know, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. It's been 60 years. Generation in the Bible is 40. It's been 60 years since John F. Kennedy was elected and then later on assassinated some years later. It's been 32 years since the end of Ronald Reagan's administration to today. John F. Kennedy was the 35th president of the United States. Donald Trump is the 45th. There have been basically 10 presidents over 15 elections over the last 60 years, if my arithmetic is right. And to the best of my discovery, uniquely enough, 5 of those presidents were Democrats and 5 of them were Republicans. And so I'm not talking about party here. I'm just presenting to all of us for consideration a understanding, a realization that we have come a long way from President Eisenhower, who was elected for 2 terms in the 1950s, World War II hero, 5-star general of the United States Army, architect of Normandy and the D-Day invasion, to the point, brethren, where we today are at the crossroads of choosing between socialism, Marxist globalism, and American nationalism. If you and I and you out there on the internet don't begin to recognize this, then as I said last week, you need to go get another cup of coffee. You really do need to begin to wake up. We are on a precipice, I mentioned last week. We're at a crossroad. You can put it any way you want to characterize it, but we are at a D-Day moment. You know what D-Day means? Decision Day moment. A Decision Day moment. And it is very important that we understand that our country, for obvious reasons, has been infiltrated with globalists, socialists, and I dare say, I'll go the one step further, communists. Within our government, within our education, within our entertainment, our judicial systems, all of these areas have been infected with something that is counterintuitive to everything our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and in this land, prophetically speaking, Manasseh stands for in terms of the birthright blessings that we've been the recipients of and of which you and I and all you here in this room have been the beneficiaries of for pretty much all our lives. As a matter of fact, this period of post-World War II has been a lot of fun, frankly. I think if I took a survey, I mean, we could travel everywhere we wanted to go. All you needed was a passport. I could walk into a restaurant without covering my nose and mouth and actually eat. I could make love to my wife without a mask on. I mean, what have we come to? What have we come to? And we laugh. Yeah, we laugh at the ideas of these. The pictures are rather comical. But brethren, I'm not mistaken. There are governors in the United States who are claiming that you should wear a mask when you make love in bed, in your bedroom with your wife. Governors! Real governors that we've elected and put into office. It's amazing. It's amazing, brethren. And yet, some don't recognize it. They don't recognize it. They don't see it. And yet, we are today up against the wall. We have a globalist running against a nationalist for re-election. I've been cautioned not to mention names. But I think you can draw the dots or the lines to the dots. And why would I say a globalist? Let me explain. I'm not talking about personalities here, brethren. It's not about Joe Biden. It's not about Donald Trump. Oops. You know. It's not about Democrats. It's not about Republicans. It really isn't. I said it before. I'm going to say it again, brother. Listen to me. Watch my lips. It's about policy. What is best to preserve the country for what it stands for as defined, not by any man, not by any party, but by the policies of the men that are running. And in this case, I am saying one is a globalist. Why would I say that? Am I just being reckless with the term? No, I'm not. If you've been listening to the policies out of the mouth of these men, you will know that one is a globalist, one is a nationalist. One is for globalist initiatives, while another one is for preserving sovereign rights, freedoms, and liberties as defined by the American Constitution and the Bill of Rights, Federalist Papers, and even our own Declaration of Independence, all included. It's all part of it. Why do I say he's a globalist? Well, brethren, let me say this. Policy. I want to re-engage into the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I want to take the American assets and reconnect them, even though it's been cut. I want to reconnect them so that we can share the wealth and share the jobs. I want to reconnect to the Paris Climate Accord. The Paris Climate Accord about the environmental Green New Deal and so forth. I want to reconnect even though it's been cut. I want to roll back tariffs on China. I wonder why. Well, I think many of us already have a good idea on that one. And in so doing, what we're going to do is we're going to raise taxes. We're going to destroy the oil industry and create new jobs in the new way of making energy. In the meantime, we'll ground all the airplanes and you guys can go back to covered wagons and horses. You know, I'm being facetious. But also, the Cascadia project and plan, which is all about making Washington, not Washington, D.C., that's another thing, but let me say the Cascadia plan about the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, California, dividing them up, and making at least 5 to maybe 7 to 8 new states out of those 3 states, and then add Washington, D.C. in and bring in Puerto Rico. What's that all about? It's about packing Congress, brethren. That's the way politics works, because more congressional districts become part and parcel to those population centers, of which we all understand, I think if we've been drinking enough coffee, to know that the West Coast of the United States is quite different than Mid-America. So, we have these things all on the table. And the question is, what will the people choose? And why do I say that? Because, brethren, we have the freedom to let our voice be heard as God watches what the people want. The colonists were basically embedded in a Judeo-Christian framing. I want to present to you a perspective for your consideration. I'm not trying to bend any arms here. I'm not trying to really change any minds. But I want you to consider these things seriously, brethren. We are a generation that is at the Y in the road. And what happens in 3 days from now has the potential of changing everything that you and I have come to know and recognize, serious as the United States of America. Manasseh, prophetically speaking, the birthrighted nation. And I know as well as you do that the prophecies are already written that this country is going to come down. But going into this with our eyes wide open, what a shame it would be if we could not prolong it so that we could continue to do God's work and preserve our culture and society for our children, our children's children, and our children's children's children to the third and fourth generations. What is so bad about that? To desire to do that, to participate in helping, hopefully to avoid a major turn or downturn in this nation's history? It's in our hands, brethren. Why do I say that? Because you and I have the right, the civic right, to let our voices be heard. I can't emphasize this enough. It is a government of, by, and for the people. The colonies, yeah, they were embedded in a Judeo-Christian background. And frankly, what better people, when you think about the beginning of our nation, could there be in voting for their elected officials than those that are embedded with a Christian framing, a Christian background, a Christian perspective, worldview? That was the way. And that was what was all part of making this country to become what it was, as well as, of course, God's blessings and the fulfillment of the prophecies that we certainly do appreciate and understand. But these were people back then and throughout the course of the history of our United States who exercised their civic right in being involved in providing a voice in the roles of leadership for the management of the country at that time, as it grew toward its maturity and its development. And I venture to say that if some of our forefathers were alive today, and I understand some of them were deists, I understand some of them were agnostic, I understand they were not all Christian, I understand that, but there were also some Christians. And I think, if I can dare say this, that our forefathers, our political forefathers, for all that they fought for, would be shocked, maybe even outraged, that we would not have enough care, concern, emotional interest in what we have for our children, our children's children, your wife, me, you. All of us together as families. Those colonists, if the truth were known, were quite content until old King George III started getting greedy and started taxing everything from paper to postage stamps and to finally, we all know the story about the tea and throwing it overboard and all that. Taxation without representation, it was called, basically. And finally, it got to the point where it got so dicey that it resulted into violence. And to be it known, the vast majority were against that of the colonies. As a matter of fact, until I found out here recently, a couple of years back when I was up in Ottawa, I went to a museum because I had a few extra days to spend up there and some time. So I went to a museum just to see some Canadian history or history from a Canadian point of view. And I found out something I was never taught in school here in the States. And that was some of the colonists left the colonies and went north because they were tired of all the rigmarole that was going on with the violence and everything. And these revolutionaries, this guy like Samuel Adams and other guys that were running around like Thomas Jefferson and all these guys sitting in these taverns making plans with the soldiers standing there by the bar, in the very bar that I was at in Boston, as a matter of fact, the one bar that's still preserved, and they sat there writing their plans on how they were going to overthrow England. And some of these colonists didn't like it. They left. They went up into Ottawa. They went up into Montreal. They went up into Ontario there in the far east side of Ontario. And that's where they settled. And that's where they became a people up there. And today we know them as Canadians. but not all of them, of course. My point is, brethren, a small percentage, a very minor amount of the population was basically involved in this uproar. And consequently, it caused these Christ-believing colonists to take defensive action, which, being led by the Black Robes Regiment, remember the sermon I gave on the Black Robes Regiment? These were the pastors. Their whole congregations were actually part and parcel to the heart and core of these revolutionaries. Amazing. Even the Brits knew that if they could get rid of these Black Robe Regiment guys, they would perhaps cut the head off of the snake and put to settle down these revolutionaries. But the reality was, didn't happen. And these Black Robe Regiment leaders continued to proceed with what they did, along with many of the rebels and the militias that raised up, and we know the rest is history. You know, sometimes I think we as human beings look at God as this, almost like a magician, where he's just going to kind of, because we need his help, intervene automatically. And somehow through intervention, solve all of our problems, like hocus pocus, abracadabra, poof, it's all going to be made right and good. I agree, brethren, God does intervene from time to time, without a doubt. Without a doubt, God does intervene from time to time. But I think it's important for us not to fail to remember how God also, in the Bible, illustrated that the people rejected him. I'm not going to turn to many scriptures, but if you have a piece of paper and pencil, you may want to write these down. I'm going to blitz through them rather quickly because I want to keep this moving because I don't have a whole lot of time. I already touched on 1 Samuel chapter 8 with regards to the people rejecting God and Samuel being upset over the fact that he thought he was owning it and he thought that they were rejecting him. And God said, settle down, Samuel. It's not about you. It's about me. They're rejecting me. God didn't intervene. You know what God did? God let the people have what they wanted. God let the people have what they wanted. And so he gave them a king. And again, let me just summarize. The rest is history. In Jeremiah chapter 23, verse 32, God did not choose those prophets that were sent in some cases that we see written in the Bible. These were choices that the people made. Oh, I've heard the voice of God. Praise Jesus. I had a dream. And so now I go running off. Like old Oral Roberts did, where he said, if I don't raise $1 million, the Lord's going to call me back home to heaven. I loved old Garner Ted Armstrong when he said this. I have to bring this back up. It was so poignant and it was so fitting when he said, well, you know what? I always thought that that's where you wanted to go, was to go back home with the Lord, Oral. So, shucks, if indeed that's where you want to go back, Oral, to heaven, to be with the Lord, maybe you ought to pray that the $1 million doesn't get raised so you can die and go home to the Lord. Made perfect sense to me, you know. But people don't think about that. Why? Because it was a scam. It was a scam to raise $1 million because they needed money for the college or whatever it was. And it was just a technique, a tactic that they used to leverage to get their hand in your pocket, play on your heart. You know, we don't want old Oral Roberts to die. And some of these guys and gals that are on Sunday television, it's amazing, brethren, that they even speak about the things they speak, because in some cases, as you, even you know, and you can watch them, and in a half hour, maybe even in 10 minutes, you can know. They don't know what they're talking about. They absolutely don't know what they're talking about. They don't have a clue, in some cases, about what you understand in the keyhole peak that God has afforded you the privilege of being able to see, recognize, understand, and know in your heart of hearts. No, brethren, God did not choose all the kings of Israel. Hosea chapter 8, verse 4. God did not choose all the kings of Israel. He allowed some to kill their brother. He allowed some sedition and conspiracy, selfishness to engage, to kill off the king. The son wanted the throne, so he killed him, and so forth and so on. And God had nothing to do with that. He says, Hosea 8, 4, I had nothing to do with some of the kings that you chose. God watched. God's a watcher too. He doesn't intervene all the time. Now, I'm not saying he doesn't intervene. Don't take me out of context. He does intervene, but it's his prerogative to pull the trigger and get involved when he feels the need and necessity to proceed and get involved. We talked about Caleb and Joshua, the 12 that went out, and they went ahead and they spied out the promised land. They came back. Joshua and Caleb were all gung-ho. Let's take the land, man. God's for us. Who can be against us? Let's just do it. And the other 10 said, no. They're too big. They're just too tough. We can't do that. We might die. And guess what? The 10 got their way. God didn't intervene to stop it, to change it. He did consign them to 40 years in the wilderness. But, and by the way, Caleb and Joshua had to suffer in the wilderness for 40 years, even though they didn't want to. But they were good soldiers, and they soldiered up. We could go on and on, brethren. So much can be said about these decisions that were made, but not necessarily by God. This building, 1835, built by 18 people in a congregation back in 1835, almost now, 185, I don't know, can't do it real fast in my head here, but you know what I'm saying, how old this building is. And this building has a colorful background in history. This congregation, I don't know how many people right off the top of my head who were in it in 1840 or 1850 prior to the Civil War. I don't know how many were in the congregation, but I do know this, brethren, this congregation, Sunday keeping people who claimed the name of Christ, were active in the abolition movement. They got involved. They said slavery is wrong. So what are we going to do, folks? The government says, you know, it's all right to do this, but it's not all right. Are you with me? Let's smuggle him up to Detroit and get him into Windsor. And that's what they did some 150 years ago. This congregation did that. Why? Because people became active and made decisions in the right way based on this word and exercised their freedom of choice and got involved. How did God handle the apostasy of the worldwide Church of God? I was a member of that church for 12 years. My wife and I in 1971 or two got baptized. We were in that church until about 1979 very comfortably, in cruise control. But then 1975 came along and Herbert W. Armstrong said, "You women need to go into the ladies' room and wash that dirt off your face because you can't wear makeup because makeup is a sin." What? Where's that one? And furthermore, Peter had the primacy in 1980-81. Peter was the chief apostle. He was the leader of the church. It was a top-down. My wife and I went into spin-out in 1979, 1980, just to share with you a little bit of the cognitive dissonance we went through of what was happening. Whoa, 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 whoa. I didn't think Peter had the primacy. Didn't James make the decision? Wasn't James, the half-brother of Jesus, the one in Jerusalem in Acts 15? Do we remember these things? Who made the edict? It wasn't Peter. Peter was just part of the herd. He spoke. People listened. But James says, "Let my edict," in Acts 15. Look it up. So what's going on here? And it caused my wife and I to launch into getting Herbert Armstrong's autobiography, using that as our roadmap to go out to Gene's schoolhouse, to go down to Salem, West Virginia, to obtain Herbert W. Armstrong's credentials from the Church of God Seventh Day, to connect the dots into the history, to make sure that maybe I've been scammed from the start. Maybe this is nothing more than a big lie, and that the Word of God that I'm seeing is nothing more than an illusion because I'm hypnotized. And so I went through these things. And brethren, through the grace of God, through the inspiration of His Holy Spirit, certainly, but in choices along the way, I had to come to a conclusion. I had to come to a conclusion. I'm leaving in 1983. And I left. I didn't hear no voice saying, "Bill, get the heck out of Dodge. It's time to leave. You've seen enough. Go, 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 go." No, I didn't hear no voices. I didn't have no dreams. Margie and I talked. Husband and wife. Studying intensely for 4 years, from 79 to about 83, when we made the choice to pull the trigger and leave. No voices. No twitches. No tinglings in my leg, you know, like Chris Matthews. Nothing like that, brethren. It was coming to a decision based on the information that we saw in terms of the policy change, or in this case, doctrinal changes. We recognized them for what they were because they didn't fess up with what we were originally taught through the correspondence courses written by C. Paul Meredith and all those mentors of mine coming through that development in those first 10 to 12 years. And we said, you know what? They are going off the rails. It's not me and my bad attitude. No, no, no. Not me. I've got a good attitude. And now I see God is showing me something. But you know what? My point, God did not make the decision for us, brethren. No, He didn't make the decision for us. We had to make that decision. Like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They stood in front of Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar said, "Bow down." They said, "You know what? We can't do that. We can't do that." Those three boys, and they were young men, stood and faced off with Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. It took a lot for them to do that, because they were no small force within the Babylonian government. They were already well ensconced in the administration of Nebuchadnezzar. These were men that had esteem, respect, and reputation. They said, "Nebuchadnezzar, look, We don't know if we're going to die or live, but we can tell you this, we're not bowing. Did God intervene before? No. Why wouldn't God intervene? Well, let me suggest something. Would it not be plausible and reasonable for God to see where the hearts of these three guys really are? What was behind the sacrifice of Isaac and Abraham? Was that all about just seeing if it would go through for no reason? No. God was testing the heart of Abraham. That's why he said, "Now I know. Now I know." How did he know? Because Abraham was about ready to plunge the knife into Isaac. How did God know that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were on his side? Because he watched them make a decision. He watched the furnace go up seven times. They watched the guys that threw them in to the furnace burn up in front of their eyes. So they knew this was the real deal. I mean, there was no doubt about the fact in their minds they knew that they were going to be, no pun intended, cooked. And they got thrown in there, all bound up, your Bible says, with the guys that threw them in there burning up right when they threw them into the furnace. And they hit the furnace. Nebuchadnezzar's watching. And then lo and behold, they got up. A fourth one was seen. He says, what's going on here? And then God intervened, you see. He didn't intervene, though, until after the fact. Why? What will the people do? Is the question. What will the people say? Is the question. Why doesn't God intervene right now and just put one of those guys down with a heart attack or something? Why doesn't God intervene right now and just read an indictment and take the guy off to jail? Knock him out of the race. Perhaps, I'm just saying, and I'm just suggesting a consideration. He wants to know what the people will do. You know, it may not be, brethren, right or wrong, to vote or not to vote. Church of God International doesn't have a policy on that. You're free moral agents. You can decide on what you do and what you want to do with that. But it does say something about you. It doesn't have to be right or wrong. But it does, regardless, say something about you. I'll come back to that in a moment, brethren. But we are right now heading into something that is very, very serious. And God can intervene. He's intervened before. He's intervened with Nebuchadnezzar. He's intervened with Cyrus. We've got biblical precedent for that. He's even intervened with the jackass of Baal, the donkey, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about. And made the donkey talk. He made the donkey talk to bring a message to the people. But in some cases, brethren, God's silence says a lot about the people, because whether or not we understand it, we're involved in a set of circumstances and conditions that are defining for who we are. And so, as I said, it doesn't have to be right or wrong with regards to voting, but it does say something about us. There are sins or actions of commission, and there are sins and actions of omission. And each and every one of those cases tells God about you and what you do. How do you handle crises? How do you handle your choices? when you're confronted with certain circumstances, how is it that you react? And maybe, because God does intervene, He affords us certain exposures and conflicts in our lives, maybe due to a combination of decisions we've made, self-inflicted, and or maybe even steering us in certain ways to get some growth out of us and get us out of our comfort zone. Margie and I got thrown into a situation in 79, like I said, that threw us out of our comfort zone. We were very happy in the Worldwide Church of God. I've got very fond memories of the Worldwide Church of God. I wouldn't have wanted it any other way. I needed the discipline, the leadership examples that came from many of the guys that I got to know in the ministry as well as within the congregation. And it was a pleasant, growing experience for me personally, and I believe my wife as well. It wasn't like that for everybody. I understand that. But the reality of it is, how we respond and react to certain situations and conditions oftentimes tells God a lot about our character, our temperament, the level of our patience. How we respond to things is certainly very important for us to recognize. And in that, and basically what I'm saying is that sometimes we need to understand that we may be the solution or the problem. And that's why we need to look deep, brethren. We need to look very deep into addressing the circumstances we find ourselves confronted with. Because in this case, in today, in this moment, 3 days before probably the most important election, this side of the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, we are on a precipice, a Y in the road, backs against the wall, facing a very, very important decision. Does this country go Marxist globalist? Or does this country remain nationalistic and sovereign and true to the freedoms and liberties that were originally established in this country? That's for all of us to seriously consider, because we are heading into some very defining moments for our national heritage and culture, and the direction, as I say, of the country is in the balance. And this election cycle, brethren, and let me just interrupt myself here for a moment, this election cycle does portend not to end well, meaning whoever wins this, whether it be Donald Trump or Joe Biden, be prepared for violence. And I'm suggesting to take some time to prepare. There's no telling how serious we're heading in. There's no telling what the degree of loss or violence is going to show up and manifest. And I'm not trying to scare you. I'm just being pragmatic. I'm just being seriously pragmatic about this. It's no secret. Black Lives Matter, Antifa, and those are just the two top tiers. There are other sub-tiers that have infiltrated this country from areas outside of this country as well as within this country that do not like the United States of America. They want Manasseh down on its face. Why? Because we represent an obstacle to the establishment of a globalist government. It's all about globalism, brethren. The policies tell me that. Not the man, not the party, the policies tell me that. And it's clear that these policies are globalist and Marxist in underpinning. When you look at some of these groups, their origins and the people that are running them, and or, more importantly, follow the money, who is financing them? During the feast, we had Black Lives Matter people up at the Holiday Inn on Route 82. Who's paying for those rooms? Who's paying for the bus tickets and airplane tickets to truck these people into these areas. There's proof that some of these people that are seen in different cities are the same people that were in the other city. Who caused them to get from point A to point B? Who's paying the bill, the hotel bill and the food and all the things? Well, I'll tell you, it's not a secret. It's the social Marxists who hate this country and want to burn it down. This has nothing to do, brethren, nothing to do with some of the purported reasons for the violence and rioting. It's about tearing our country down. So I simply say these things, brethren, because they are distinct policy differences that are indeed represented by two candidates, of which I won't belabor, but as I've said, representing two separate and different ideologies. So I hope, as I close this up here, I hope that we're all willing to stand and to make a stand. First and foremost, to make a stand for what this Bible says. Without a doubt, that's not a question at all. Because what we believe is very important to our perspective, our outlook, and how we digest this information and concern, and hopefully translate it into either action or non-action. But I hope also, in addition, that you'll make a stand for your country, for liberty, and for freedom. And why do I say that? Because, brethren, we stand to lose our freedoms and liberties. And if that happens, we will stand to lose our religious freedoms as well. They'll be coming after you, if indeed you do make the stand for God. Because if you make the stand for God, like old Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, at some point you're going to be facing your fiery furnace too. And we'll have to make a decision. And that decision, either you suffer and make it for Christ and face the consequences, or you cave, compromise, and give it up. In the worldwide Church of God, the manifestation was that many tens of thousands gave it up. It would have maybe happened a different way, but that way, with an apostasy setting in over a period of 9 years, it took the Catholic Church 900 years to create an apostasy. It took the worldwide Church of God 9 years to successfully generate an apostasy that literally destroyed the faith of tens of thousands of people. Guess what? I just hope, like the Apostle John said, they were never of us. Because if they were of us, they wouldn't have left us. But because they were never of us, hopefully, for their sakes, they were never of us. Because tens of thousands derailed and went off, only to be manifested that their hearts and their minds were not here. At some point, a beast is going to rise. At some point, you're going to be forced to receive a mark, a governmental substance of some sort. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in the weeks to come. But at some point, are going to be required to receive something that is going to mark you so that you are a qualified and fully accepted citizen of this beast. The thing that stands between you and the emergence of that in all of its glory and power, and I say that facetiously as described in Revelation 17, is the United States of America and the obstacle that we present to them as a balance of power to stop this nonsense of Marxism and globalism. Once that is done and the United States is neutralized and there is no more America, and your Bible says that time will come, without a doubt. It's written in the Scriptures, unless we repent as a nation. I wouldn't hold your breath on that, but stranger things have happened. Yet, nevertheless, it's important, brethren, that we recognize that we are indeed on a precipice. So, I say to all of you here on the internet, brethren, again I ask, are you riders in the storm? And what I mean by that, it's a metaphor. I realize you're not a Pony Express guy riding out in the range, you know, in a raincoat, you know, trying to dodge Indians and deal with the weather. I say that as a metaphor because you're sitting there at home probably in your living rooms. You're sitting here in church. Maybe you're in a motel room somewhere. But the reality of it is, brethren, like it or not, wherever we may be, I say as metaphorically speaking, we are riders in a storm. We are surrounded by tension and blockbuster movements that run the risk of ultimately getting to your homes in the suburbs, ultimately getting to your pockets through taxes, ultimately getting to you to infringe upon your freedom so that you can't move about like you used to unless you have a certain, I don't know, vaccine. I'm just saying, prepare, brethren. Prepare. Begin to start thinking. That's how you prepare. You must start thinking futuristically. Think out ahead. Think out ahead. We are in a moment. I don't want to sound hyperbolous. I'm just trying to get us to recognize the reality that we are in is indeed a serious one. And again, I say, so are we just riders in the storm or are we warriors? Are we activists or are we pacifists? The choice is ours. We can let our voice be heard. We can. With a vote, for starters. For starters. Or we can sit on our hands and do nothing. And that's our right. That's our freedom. It's a freedom in Christ. It's a freedom in CGI. We're not going to say anything about it. It's freedom. You're a sovereign person. You have freedom of choice. You can do what you want in that regard. But keep in mind, no vote is a vote. No vote is a vote. A vote of omission. And it will have an effect. It will have an effect. And whether it's right or wrong is not material. That's not even in this equation. It's not right or wrong. It's what does it say about you? What does it say about you? How is it that you're viewed from yourself? Am I an activist? Am I a Joshua? A Caleb? Or am I of the other 10? Am I of the first 22,000 that left in fear when Gideon said, those of you who are afraid and want to go home, go home. They were gone. 10,000 left out of 32,000. First and foremost, those 22,000 guys hit the road and got out of Dodge. See you, Gideon. Have a good life. Gone. Right or wrong, it said a lot about those 22,000 guys. Right or wrong. So, are you an activist or a pacifist? Are you just a rider in the storm? Or are you a warrior? The choice is yours, brethren. But just keep in mind, we can't get out of this one. We are all in the storm. We are all part of the storm. Like it or not, we are here. So keep in mind, no vote is a vote. And I ask, What does that say about you? And perhaps, most importantly, I wonder what God thinks about that.